Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. It is, of course, December now. We're officially in winter, but we will attempt to try and keep you warm with the heat of the rockets that project us all to Planet Porky. And, of course, at the controls, most of the time, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how's the universe looking on this fine day?
It's looking cool down this end. Yeah, the weather's changing, that's for sure. Yep. But, you know, I quite welcome it. I quite like these closed-in foggy evenings.
Yeah, so do I. If only it was the real world. And, you know, thankfully, since you and I last spoke, it looks like the vaccine really is going to happen now and it's going to help us all. Thankfully, we appear to be at the start of the end, so to speak, and life might return to normal. But I cannot wait to get back into those quintessential Middle England pubs, roaring log fires and all that kind of stuff. And one of these days, Ms. Jones will get in there and have lunch in one of those great hostelries. But before we do that, I have to say to you that one of my favourite hostelries, actually, in the whole of the world, is one in Connecticut called the Yankee Clipper. And the Yankee Clipper is an old coaching tavern in Connecticut, obviously, and has been there ever since the War of Independence. You know, it's just a beautiful white clapperboard building. And the people I used to go there with were my old pals in Newcastle, Ivor Key, who we talked about last week, who sadly has passed on at the age of 85, had a good life, Ivor. And the gentleman who found him, George Gordon, who you branded as having expired and being dead, but I have found out he's not.
Well, he's turned out to be very much alive, and I feel desperate about this.
I think you should.
Because, you know, well, I wouldn't pronounce anyone dead for the sake of it. I think I must have mixed him up with Dermot Pegavy, who was another columnist on the Daily Mail when I was there.
He was.
And whenever I came into New York to do an assignment or whatever, an interview, cover a gig, doorstep someone, whatever, terrorize someone, I always hung out in Costello's with George Gordon and Dermot Pegavy.
That's right.
So I think I've mixed up the two and assumed, because Dermot is definitely dead.
Oh, Dermot is definitely dead. He died a couple of years ago.
Yeah. So I think I must have mistaken George. So I'm terribly sorry, George.
Yeah.
If this ever reaches your ears, I am so sorry to have pronounced you deceased when you're very much still with us.
But you did actually find a George Gordon who has died, didn't you?
Well, that was the funny bit, because
an old George Gordon who's still alive.
I went trawling the internet, you see, because I wanted to find out for myself, and I found not an obituary exactly, but it was one of these funeral home type things where you can send flowers and your condolences to Irene, the widow, and X number of children with all these different names. And I thought, well, that must be him, because I knew that he lived in somewhere upstate New York. So I was convinced that I'd found the deceased George Gordon, but obviously there were more than one.
There is definitely more than one. And Dermot Pegavy, by the way, he was a great guy as well. He wrote Letter from America on a Monday in the Mail years and years and years ago, and a couple of columns.
What a column that was, wasn't
Sorry?
It? What a column
it
that was.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And
very elegant turn of phrase he had.
He had a fantastic. Unfortunately, with Dermot, he married a lady much younger than him. I think she was a lawyer. She's a lovely girl, very attractive. I've forgotten her name now, but it doesn't matter. But she had rather, you know, aspirations.
I think it matters to her, probably.
Well, it would matter to her, yeah. And she's a really lovely lady, honestly. But she was very aspirational. That's why they ended up living, as you quite rightly say, in a big house in upstate New York. But Dermot was permanently broke. I mean, he earned good money on the Mail, and he wrote for magazines and that sort of thing. But all his money was spent on things like very expensive memberships for tennis clubs, you know, and ponies for the children, all this kind of stuff, you know what I mean? And he was always broke. And it all came to a head one morning when a few of the guys from the city, you know, working in New York, went up and stayed with him at the weekend. And Dermot came down for breakfast one morning, and his wife said, oh, they've run out of bacon or eggs or something like that. Could he nip down to the local shop, you know, in this lovely part of upstate New York? Dermot said, yeah, sure, no problem at all. I'll do. So he goes outside and comes back in and says, darling, where did you leave the car?
Oh, no.
And she said, I left it in the normal place. He said, no, it's not there. Anyway, it had been requisitioned overnight by the loans company because they hadn't paid the bill on it.
No.
Yeah, and that's how Dermot got himself into debt. He was always in terrible debt, poor lad. But there we are. But talking about...
So it was all for show, and which is a very shallow way to live, isn't it? It's much better to have an honest life with a lot less and to not have the pressure of all those material things than it is to try and keep up appearances.
Yes, well, I totally agree. But if you feel that social pressure amongst your peers, you know what I mean? We all earn very good money.
Well, then get different friends, you know. I mean, there isn't that kind of money in journalism anymore either.
No, there aren't.
Most of the journalists I know today are sort of 0 hours contracts and scrapping around for the rent.
Oh, I totally agree. But in those days, we did very well. I mean, we had tax-free money paid in from England at $2.4 to the pound, which was a National Union of Journalists agreement. We had very big expense accounts. No problem about getting a stretch limo to take us to the theatre. It was a great and glorious life, and you had to sort of keep up, you know. But anyway, look, there we go.
They were different days, weren't they?
Oh, totally different. Totally different. Yeah. But anyway, let's talk about the two other characters involved in this story: George Gordon and Ivy Key, deceased, R.I.P.
Neither of whom, hang on, I was going to say, one of whom is dead and the other of whom is very much still
with us. Very much still with us. So after our last conversation, you said George was dead. I actually went and found an old paper contacts book. I mean, we talked about contacts books in our last podcast, and I still have one. And it's got numbers in it now, which must be, you know, I don't know, 20, 30 years old. So I look through this, and the pages are even coming out of it. That's how old it is, okay? And I find Gordon, George, and a Connecticut telephone code number. And I thought, well, I'll give it a try. I rang it. It picked up at the other end, yeah. Hello? And I said, George, Mike Parry. Oh, Mike, how are you? George is a West Country man, by the way. You might have guessed from my imitation of his accent.
I thought it was Pakistani.
That's very nice, isn't it? Thank you. And then George tells me the full story. George always had a very acerbic wit. He was a great guy. I mean, having a beer or, you know, a couple of gin and tonics with George after work in Costello's was always a highlight of the week. He was a terrific journalist as well. And I said, well, what happened? So he said, well, he said, I won't try to imitate his West Country accent all the way through this story.
No, don't.
He said he got a call from somebody who'd sent Ivor about 3 emails in the past 24 hours. And then somebody else, he checked with somebody else who said, no, I'd sent Ivor a text yesterday, hasn't replied. He said, OK, George only lives 4 miles away. So George drove over and he went to the house, and the back door that leads onto the deck was open, which is normal in that part of the world, you know. If you're in there in the daytime, you only sort of lock it up.
Let the raccoons in for a bit of a supper
that. Exactly, that sort of thing. So George went in, and the TVs were on in the lounge, and the lights were on, but there's no sign of Ivor. And so George went upstairs, three or four bedrooms, looked in them all, no. And it's a typical American house. It has a big cellar. So he went down into the cellar, looked around. No, because Ivor had an office down in his cellar with TV screens and that sort of thing. You know, he thought, this is very funny. Went back into the lounge, but walked further into the lounge than he had at first to find Ivor dead, lying sort of prostrate on his couch. So he was hidden to George the first time by the back of the couch. You see what I mean?
Do you think you might mean prostrate?
Prostrate, that's right. What did I say?
Prostate.
Oh, prostate. Now, that's
a whole different ball game.
A whole different ball game.
Ball game. Get it?
That starts to worry men of my, you know, age. But anyway, not yet, thank God. I just thought I'd let you know that, you know. So anyway, so George picks up the phone and dials 911, which is obviously the American equivalent of 999, gets through to the ambulance people and says, I need an ambulance and I'm not sure whether you need to alert the police, you know. So lady says, what is the problem, sir? And George explained that he'd come round to his mate's house and found out that his friend had died. Okay. Are you certain, sir, that this gentleman is deceased? And George said, oh, yes, he's definitely deceased. He said, I looked for a pulse and all that. There's nothing there. You know, he's...
Well, maybe even he felt for one.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And the lady said, and how long... do we anticipate that the deceased gentleman has been deceased?
This lady has just moved from Miami to Seattle in about the last 30 seconds. Yeah.
And George said, Well, he said, I estimate it must be about 24 hours because nobody's heard from him for about 36 hours and there was an overnight. So I think probably about 24 hours. She said, we have to be extremely certain about these things, sir. I would like you to give the man who you believe to be deceased the kiss of life.
Off to you.
So George,
necrophilia is dead boring. I have
to... So George said, this is ridiculous. He said, I don't wish to, you know, be sort of, you know, specific about this, but his lips are blue, you know, and sort of.
I don't know why I'm laughing. I'm so sorry.
Well, I mean, look, you know, it's gallows humour, isn't it?
Poor,
you know, George told me like this, you know. So George sort of turned that one down, okay?
So you're supposed to kiss a man who's blue in the face.
You know.
I mean, I suppose it wouldn't be the first time.
Maybe. It's a bit harsh, isn't it? Yeah, but anyway, fortunately, a neighbour then came in. Who'd seen George arrive, you know, from across the road.
And, you kiss him. No, do it.
No, George said, no, you know, this is ridiculous. And then the neighbour had already alerted Ivor's daughter, who wasn't far away, and all that kind of stuff, and so he got sorted out. But I'll tell you the other amazing thing is, and this happens in America, and in fact, you can tell me in a minute how it happened to John Lennon. Ivor was then taken away by the authorities, and his daughters, one who lived in California, she's a very successful TV executive, the other one lived nearer New York, decided on an instant cremation, and there was no funeral, and it was all done in 24 hours.
Were they Jewish?
No.
Oh, that's interesting. You wouldn't normally expect that outside of the Jewish faith.
Yeah, well... it happened to John Lennon, presumably, because they didn't want any sign of a grave. Is that right? Or
No, it's not true at all. John was cremated upstate a few days after his death. There wasn't any rush to do
right.
it. What we don't know is where the ashes
That's
are.
What I mean.
Some people believe that they are underneath the mosaic in Strawberry Fields across the road in Central Park, but there's nothing to prove that. Yoko may still have the urn.
Yeah.
In her house.
Yeah.
My mother, for example, still has my father's ashes in the urn in the house
right.
because she wasn't sure whether she was going to move house.
Yeah.
There was a plan to bury my father's remains underneath a yellow rose tree in the back garden, which he really loved.
Right.
But then she thought maybe she moved. She didn't want to leave in there.
Yeah.
So they're still sitting there. And it's quite common for people to... Simon Kinnersley had his mother in the minstrels gallery in his house down in Bristol for years and years. And he said, well, she's been here so long now, doesn't see much point in doing anything else with
Sorry,
her.
Who was that?
She might as well stick around.
Who was that?
Simon Kinnersley, do you remember?
Kinnersley.
He was a journalist on the Daily Mail
years ago. Yeah. Well, that's all very odd, isn't it?
But I don't think there is any great rush to cremate unless there is a religious reason.
No, there was no
like
religious reason. This was only I spoke to George only 3 days after Ivor died, and he said it's all been done. He said, don't ask me why. And I said, well, what about a funeral service? Morris? No, he said there won't be one. He said I wasn't asked to attend anything. He said it's been done, and that's it. The family don't want to speak about it. Ivor sadly hadn't spoken to one of his daughters for 5 years.
Oh dear. Well, maybe the one in California just had to go back to work, so they had to get it all done and dusted.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but I mean,
dust to dusted.
Yeah, but
before she could go back to work.
Yeah, but come off it, you know, your father only dies once in your life. You say to whoever you're working with, or even if
you, well, you say that, and we don't know. You know, we thought George Gordon was dead, and he's not actually.
Well,
dead.
Well, no, so but I mean,
maybe he's one of those with nine lives.
Yeah, but no, but that was your mistake, Miss Jones. But no, what I'm saying is, you say to your employer, or if you run your own production company, like I think Ivor's daughter might do. Say, look, I'm sorry, my father's died. I'm taking 3 or 4 days off. I've got to make the arrangements. I mean, my mum sadly died 2 years ago, actually, just last month. And it was a month before we could get through, you know, everything and have the funeral because of so much
same
probate
thing. Yeah.
And all that kind
same,
of stuff. You know?
Same for my dad.
Yeah.
We had to wait 2 days under a month
yeah.
for the funeral, which in some ways I felt that was quite a good thing because... Yeah. By the time it came to the funeral, we were very serene
yeah.
and contained,
yeah.
and we had come to terms with it. So we weren't weeping and gnashing teeth and all that on the day. Yeah. We were quite up for seeing everybody, actually.
Sure.
And it was a lovely funeral, and my father would have really enjoyed it.
Sure. I don't like funerals. I don't like going to them anymore. But
yeah, I don't mind them anymore. Yeah, but, and it's not the end, you know. It's not the end. It's only a sort of moment in time, isn't
it? Yeah, I feel a bit weird about them. But anyway, I feel weird when I see a hearse pass by. I really do. And I sometimes...
Do you?
Yes, I do, yeah. And when I used to do a late show at Talk Sport, driving home at sort of 3 a.m, right, I always took a detour from the quickest way home because it passed a funeral business where the ambulances would be queuing up because most people die at 2 a.m. And then the ambulance brings them from the hospital to the funeral parlour, to the chapel of rest, you know. And it used to really spook me at that time in the morning. So I would always go the other way. Anyway, nicer things to talk about. I didn't tell you the great story about Ivor Costello, as you know very well. We were in there one time and it was midwinter and there was about 3 foot of snow on the ground. And it was a fantastic, you know, New York winter.
I love New York like
so
that.
So do I.
It's just, oh, it's wonderful.
It is absolutely
it's
wonderful.
So fabulous.
And anyway, what happened was we were all going off somewhere, but we'd recently been over to Brooklyn and seen this Polish tailor who made us all fantastic sheepskin coats with fantastic fold-back lapels. You see what I mean? You know, huge coats, wonderful coats that would keep out the minus 25 chill in New York. When you get that wind chill factor blowing across Manhattan, you know what I mean? And and anyway, we'd all had an awful lot to drink and we were waiting for the car to come and get us a stretch limo. So one of the guys went outside to see if the car was there. And I can't remember which one it was now, but it was somebody from the Telegraph, I think, or something. Anyway, he was so pissed that he went out to look for the car, but then felt tired. So he leaned forward on the bonnet of the car parked outside Costello's, because there were cars parked out on the road in those days, and he fell asleep in about like 2 minutes. So after about 5 minutes, we said, where's old Ray gone, or whatever his name was, you know?
What, he fell asleep in the snow?
He fell asleep face down on this car. He was so drunk.
So what, did he asphyxiate? Did he freeze to death?
Well, this is the point of the story. So somebody said, where's Ray? So somebody went outside and said, oh, he's outside, but he seems to have fainted and he's fallen forward on the bonnet of the car. I said, oh, well, we better get him off. He said, no, you can't. Why? He said, the temperature's going down and the wool in the lapels on his sheepskin coat are firmly attached to the ice on the front of the car. It's impossible to get him off. So we all went out, and it's true, he was welded to the car by ice. We couldn't get him off. So somebody found the owner of the car. He had to get in. And then he had to start the car and start revving the car up to warm up.
Was he dead then?
Sorry?
Was he dead?
Well, we didn't know because he was so cold. You know, we didn't know.
Oh, my God.
So we started revving the car up. And it was Ivor, actually, who started doing it. Ivor got in and said, you know, and he was revving the car up to try and warm up the bonnet so the ice would melt and we could get our mate off the car because his face was literally frozen to the car.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Anyway, police car came along, asked what we were doing. Ivor jumped out.
Oh, don't tell me. Ivor was over the limit, right?
Well, Ivor jumped down and said, isn't it bloody obvious, mate? You know, we're trying to save our mate's life here. Look at this. And it all got really out of hand. A policeman poked Ivor with his nightstick and Ivor hit him.
Oh, yeah. No. And he ended up in
He ended up in the night court. They have night courts in Manhattan to deal with people like Ivor. And he ended up there, fortunately. Yeah, honestly, he was trailed in there, handcuffed to two prostitutes, right? Yeah, yeah. I know, yeah.
Well, it's one way of doing it.
Exactly. But fortunately, you won't believe this, we knew the judge. Because the judge had, you know, lots of people used to come to Costello's in those days to meet all these great English journalists, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And the judge was one of them, so he let him go. It was a remarkable sequence of
events.
That
is very funny. Meanwhile, back at the scene of the freeze, what happened to the guy on the bonnet of the car?
Who knows? Who knows? You know, who knows?
What? So you never found out whether he was dead
or not? I'm sure he wasn't dead, because I'd have heard if somebody had died. You know, I'm sure he kind of survived and all that. But that was just the way things were. But anyway, look, that's a tale of life and death, I suppose, and we all go through it. I tell you what story has really sort of hit me this week, Leslie Ann. It's the total collapse of Debenhams, because throughout my life, Debenhams has been a major, major factor, normally and mainly because at Christmas I would pick one day when I'd go to Debenhams, and I would it's such a huge store, wherever it was, in Oxford Street or down in Guildford in Surrey or somewhere, and I'd go in there, and 3 hours later I'd come out with every single Christmas present and everything else I wanted for Christmas. It was brilliant, and have them all delivered to my house. I loved Debenhams stores. I don't know about you.
Didn't your mother work there for the longest time?
She worked there for about 33 years, my mum. And tell you what, it's interesting you should mention that, because my mum was widowed at 49. My dad sadly died when he was 58, and he was 10 years older than my mum. That was around about 1982. And so my mum was a widow at 49. She worked at Debenhams in Chester, at Browns of Chester, which was Browns of Chester, the store, but it was a Debenhams store. And I always have a laugh when I go to Chester, take a picture of it and say the Harrods of the North, you know, because it's a lovely shop. And then when my dad died, my sister lived in Bournemouth with her husband, who was a banker with Barclays, and that division existed in Bournemouth. So my mum moved down to Bournemouth, and Debenhams were ever so good. They let my mum transfer from Debenhams in Chester to Debenhams in Bournemouth, where she worked for about 20 years. And mum's whole life, once she was a widow, was her job. You know, it was, she was only part-time. She'd work from, I think it was like 10 till 3, like 4 days a week or something like that. You know what I mean? But it was her whole life. She got up in the morning only, you know, for the purpose of putting on her Debenhams outfit, you know, a brown skirt and brown blouse and all that kind of stuff, and going to work and, you know, mixing with her fellow workers. She loved the shop, and she'd come home at night, and then, you know, she'd look forward to going back tomorrow. And then she was so good, such a good worker, they kept her on until she was 72, way over the normal sort of retirement age, which I think then was fixed at sort of 64 for ladies, you know. And then at 72, you know, she got called into the office and told, look, Joan, thank you very much, but I'm afraid it is now time. And she protested and said, no, don't, and all this kind of stuff. And that literally changed her life so dramatically for the worse. After that, you know, she became depressed and she had nothing to do. And, we were having to spend more time with her, and that, which we don't mind, of course, she's our mother. But, oh, honestly, there is a benefit in allowing people as they grow older to keep working. I think it's so good for them.
I agree. My father worked until he was 74. Yeah. And then a similar thing, you know, his sports editor came to him and said, I think we need to let some of the younger guys come through now. And my father was practically on his knees begging to be allowed to continue. Mm. But of course, you don't have the same stamina. You can't go racing all over the country to go to a match every weekend. You can't be getting on and off planes the way he once did. And there obviously comes a time when you have to slow down.
Yes.
But when your job is the thing that defines you, as it was for him, as it was for your mum, it's very, very difficult to separate the individual from the employment. Yeah. And, you know, we need to encourage people to, I suppose, have more interests outside of what they do for a living before they get too old to find anything else.
No, I so totally agree with you, you know. It was heartbreaking to see the way mum missed it, you know, particularly in the first couple of years. And she'd actually go into the shop and see her old friends. And I said, mum, don't do that, honestly. You know, they'll start saying, oh, here's Joan again, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know. But she couldn't stay away because it was all she did, you know. But no, you're absolutely right.
Do you remember there was a guy, I won't say the name, just in case he's one of our fabulously devoted listeners, but he was a very senior editor at the Mail on Sunday for many, many years. And they pensioned him off in the end because he outstayed his welcome. Yeah. He was too old. He couldn't get his head around leaving. And he kept hold of his pass and his office keys.
Right.
And he was seen on the CCTV footage on a regular basis, creeping into the office during the middle of the night and sort of poking around and revisiting the back bench and, you know, looking through the cuttings books and all that kind of stuff. He couldn't stay away. It was the saddest thing.
Yeah, now I've heard of that before. There was a guy who worked on the foreign desk at the Daily Express, exactly the same guy called Jimmy Nick. And he was always known as Nick. And he did exactly the same. He'd come in at 4 a.m, right, when there was no great security in those days. I'm going back to the 80s now. And he would start bringing in sort of foreign reports for the new foreign editor who'd come in at about sort of 7:30 and say, what are you doing here? What, you know, the guy just couldn't give it up. I tell you who still, I think, works, and he's almost 80 on the Mail, is Jeff Powell.
I do know Jeff.
He must have been a colleague of your dad's in...
Well, yes. I don't particularly want to get into that, but we'll have a conversation another time.
But Jeff, yeah. I still see his byline on boxing matters like Tyson last week, and I think he's still going. Right, Miss Jones. So there we are then. You know, we've got into, all the subjects which are consuming us at the moment as we come towards Christmas, and hopefully Christmas is going to be a bit happier now that we've had news about the vaccine being rolled out, but... who really knows? I mentioned Sir Philip Green to you. What is your immediate image in your head of Sir Philip Green, the chap who is in charge of Arcadia, which includes Top Shop and everything else? Debenhams is completely separate, of course, but Sir Philip Green's empire also looks as though it might be heading south.
Well, he's an odious individual, isn't he? I mean, I absolutely think he ought to be made to pay the 13,000 redundant employees their pensions that he's depriving them of right now. But he's so abusive to journalists and to pretty much anybody who approaches him. He flaunts this kind of very suave, soigneur kind of personality. You always see him draped all over Kate Moss, or her draped all over him, because he's bought her, hasn't he, hook, line and sinker into his employ. I just think there's something horribly unpleasant about the guy, and I'm glad to see the back of him.
Yeah, the point is that when you saw those, I mean, ghastly images of Sir Philip Green wrapping not just his hand, but his whole arm around Kate Moss's neck at a fashion show and pulling her towards him, like, you know, almost like they were lovers, really. And you know, you're my possession, all that. He must have been paying her millions of pounds to promote Top Shop. And no, what I was going to say is that he always looked to me like, you'll know that in recent years, there were all sorts of reports and complaints from female employees saying that, you know, sometimes he'd drag them in and tell them to sit on his knee and ask them questions like, have you been a naughty girl? I mean, it's all so sleazy and scummy, you know what I mean? And he always looked as though he had half an eye on, you know, I don't know, trying to be a sugar daddy or something like that, you know?
Yeah, gross. Don't you think as well he should be made to sell that yacht to settle his debt?
I mean, that's very interesting. The yacht's called Braveheart, isn't it? Or Lionheart. Braveheart? Lionheart. Lionheart. Braveheart was the film, wasn't it?
I thought it was named after his wife, but maybe that's her name.
No, it's not. No, I think it is called Lionheart. It's worth £100 million. And a picture only this week of him reclining, you know, on a sun lounger on the deck, covered in like a fur blanket, believe it or not, in Monaco. I suppose it gets cold in Monaco in winter as well. And meanwhile, the empire's falling apart here. I'm just trying to think in my head, is Debenhams part of his group or not?
I thought it was.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I'm getting confused here. But he had so many shops. I mean, he had Top Shop, Top Man, Top Girl, all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
But Evans, the outside shop.
Well, he used to own, of course, British Home Stores, and he sold that.
That's right.
He sold that chain, and that went bust and all that.
For £1. But the thing is that the high street was on its last legs anyway.
Yes, it was. I agree.
And I think this has been coming for a long time. It's not anything to do with the pandemic or the coronavirus or any of that. The high street has been in decline for some years. And anybody who doesn't agree with that is actually blinkered and needs to get their head out of the sand.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I can't remember the last time I went for a shopping session in the high street.
Did you used to like...
It's just not something I do anymore.
But did you used to like, you know, a couple of hours in Selfridges or Debenhams or whatever?
Absolutely. You can go and spend a whole day in Selfridges because you can have your breakfast there, you do a bit of shopping, have your lunch, go and try a few clothes on, have your hair done. You could actually be there all day long.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I thought it was great, but that's got to go. You're absolutely right. And he never moved with the times. I mean, just look at the way Jeff Bezos has expanded his empire in such a short period of time by just literally tuning in to the new way of shopping, whilst Philip Green's empire has just been crumbling, literally crumbling, the buildings crumbling, everything else. But anyway, there we go. That's just one of those things. Did you ever come across Dave Prowse, Darth Vader?
Oh, no, I never met him personally, but a few friends of mine have been paying tribute on Facebook this week. Francoise Pascal was a very good friend of his.
Oh, right. Yeah.
She used to be in Mind Your Language on television.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember her, yeah.
Years ago. But, yeah, she's a feisty bird. But yeah, poor guy. He seemed to have been very well liked.
He seemed to be very well liked. And also, you know, mark of the man is he said, well, no, what I was most proud of was not being Darth Vader in the Star Wars film. He said I was the Green Cross Code Man and I helped millions of children learn how to cross the road properly, which I think is rather nice, isn't it?
That's a proper
You know, to say that's what I did. Now then, Miss Jones, you're going to be meeting up with an old Fleet Street colleague of both yours and mine next week. And it's going to be rather public. What is going on?
Oh, I'm very excited about this. I got an email from my old boss on the News of the World, Piers Morgan, yesterday to invite me on his Good Morning Britain show on Tuesday morning to pay tribute to John Lennon, whose 40th anniversary, can we believe, falls next Tuesday.
40th anniversary of his murder. Yeah, yes. That's not an anniversary to me. That's a commemoration. You know what I mean?
Well, it is an anniversary. So when you say, certainly in church situations, you know, somebody's George Gordon's 40th anniversary would mean it's the 40th year of his passing.
Yes, except he hasn't passed yet, of course. Obviously, we've cleared that up already.
But anyway, that's just an example. But yes, so I shall be on Good Morning Britain with Piers and Susanna next Tuesday morning.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. Well, I'm delighted for you. And you've had, of course, you've had two major milestones whilst this book has been published, haven't you? First of all, John's 80th birthday. And now, of course, the 40th anniversary commemoration or whatever of his death. And so it goes on.
His is an interesting one. I got an email today from quite a well-known radio station, from one of the executive producers, inviting me to come on the show at 6:50 next Wednesday morning, the 9th of December, to talk about John Lennon's anniversary. Right. So I emailed her back and I said, it's very interesting how you have chosen to celebrate the 9th of December because, yes, of course, John died in New York and was registered as having died on the 8th of December. But in this country, in the UK, the country of his birth, we were already into the early hours of the 9th. So I said, you know, yes, I think you'll find everybody else is commemorating it the day before. Yeah. But if you want me to still come in, oh, God, she said, I've got the wrong day.
Mm. Well, wrong and right, I suppose, because was it about 10:30 at night in New York?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was into the early hours.
3:30 in the morning here. Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Well,
so we were on the 9th and I remember going to work. Yeah. That day, which was the 9th, and I was working at Chrysalis Records in Stratford Place, just off Oxford Street, not far from Selfridges, actually. Yeah. And George Martin, the Beatles producer, had his office in the ground floor of our building. And that's where he ran Air Studios, his recording studio company. And we were all standing around in reception waiting for George to come in.
Golly, that's amazing. Yeah, absolutely amazing. Yeah. So there we are. Now, tell me, Miss Jones, have you ever taken to a sunbed to get a tan? You know, these tanning salons and all that.
Yes. I'm ashamed to say that I have.
Yeah.
And the reason I did was because I'm very pale skinned.
Right.
Back in my youth, I did lie on a sunbed from time to time because they were sold to us as being the safer option. Yeah. Don't lie in the real sun. Come and get a safe tan. Right. On these sunbeds. Mm-hmm. Well, I went on to develop three lots of skin cancer.
I mean, had surgery three times. That's utterly amazing. What do they call that? Yeah. Manola or something?
It's malignant melanoma. is the proper term. I had lesions removed from my face, from my arm and from my chest. And I'm not even a sunbaker, as I just said. You know, I don't go to the beach and lie on the beach for 6 hours at a
time. Amazing.
I'm factor 50 and under a parasol. That's me. Yeah. But I managed to develop skin cancer three times, and I can only put that down to having laid on sunbeds when I was young.
Golly, that's absolutely amazing. And unfortunately, obviously, you survived it all, but thank God you found it in time.
Well, I think I have, but it might be the George Gordon syndrome.
Well, I mean, blimey, let's hope not. We'll keep a close eye on you. The reason I ask is because I've read a report saying endometriosis linked to regular use of sunbeds. And it says that they found out now, a study of more than 116,000 women found that those who had regularly used sunbeds may have developed this terrible disease, which is a sort of thickening of ladies' skin inside their uterus and this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, why don't they just ban them? This sounds horrendous.
Yeah, well, this is endometriosis, is when tissue similar to the lining of your uterus, the womb, begins to grow in other parts of your body. So usually the ovaries, the fallopian tubes and so on.
Golly.
And it's a long-term condition. There is no cure. Yeah. And the only indication that you might have that you have it is pain in your lower back and your tummy, and if you have difficulty conceiving. Yeah. So there's no treatment, there's no cure. You can get painkillers, hormonal medication, surgery to cut it away. Now, if this is being caused by a sunbed, stay right away from it.
Exactly. I can't believe that anybody ever bothers with it now, just for the sheer vanity of looking a bit more orange or a bit ridiculously orange. I've never understood that. You wouldn't get me putting orange on my face, honestly. Why should I?
But I tell you what, you know, the stuff that comes in bottles nowadays is so good and so difficult to tell from the real thing. Why would anybody want to damage their very delicate skin by burning it on a sunbed or lying out in the garden in the sun?
No idea. Honestly, I can't imagine why anybody would do it at all. Miss Jones, you're still a driver. Did it shock you when I showed you that report which said there are 469 people in this country who are over 100 years old who still have an active driving licence?
Well, I nearly fell over backwards. No. Licences should be withdrawn at the age of 80. I've been saying this for years. My grandmother, who we called Nana, my dad's mom, at 86, she was still driving from our house just outside London all the way back to Margate, where she lived. She was Welsh, but they'd moved to the Kent coast. And between our house on the edge of Kent and her home in Margate, there were five major roundabouts. And my father used to follow her in his Triumph Stag, because he was a bit into his fancy cars.
I tell you what, that was a beautiful car. That was a beautiful car, the
Triumph Stag.
Lovely
car. He had three of those.
Oh, I loved it.
He used to follow her down to the first roundabout, so effectively to put her on the motorway. Yes. You know, so all she had to then do was go in a straight line and then come off the other end at Margate. Yeah. And he said he took her car away when he watched her drive the wrong direction around the first roundabout.
God. Yeah.
And she was 86 at that point, and he said no more. So I really don't think there is any reason why anybody over the age of 80 should be driving anymore. Not for their own safety, but for the safety of everybody else. There was a terrible case down in Westerham in Kent a few years ago where an old guy was driving along in his car in Westerham High Street, and he drove into, I think it was Costa Coffee or one of those sort of coffee shops, you know, the chains. He just smashed through the front window and killed everybody in the front, sitting at the tables, having their cup of morning coffee.
And how?
And he was an elderly driver. He was into his 80s.
Right.
So, you know, how can you have that?
No, I totally agree. When I was a young reporter on the Chester Chronicle, you did all these inquests all the time. And of course, it was great training for getting your facts right and getting the detail right and all that kind of stuff. And I was always fascinated by these inquests, you know, why people died. But one guy in an old Morris Minor, he got into his car, drove out of his driveway in his home near Cristleton, which is a suburb of Chester, and was driving down to see his mate in a place called Waverton. And he literally had a heart attack at the wheel and just dropped dead instantly. And the car just went across the road and smashed into another car coming the other way, killing all the occupants of that, right? And this guy was, as I remember, he was sort of in his 90s. I remember him being over 90. And the coroner never even made a recommendation, you know, about whether he should have been driving or not. I mean, literally car crashes waiting to happen, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I saw this happen with a bus once. Yeah. Up by the Tower of London, and the bus, I didn't know what happened at the time. I was in my car just across the other side of the road, and I saw this bus go out of control. It was a double-decker red bus, and it went out of control. It careered across the road and smashed into several other cars. And I read about it in the Evening Standard later on, and the driver of the bus had had a heart attack, and he'd killed several people, took several others with him.
The driver of the bus?
Yeah, I had a heart attack.
God, oh my. Well, look, the driver of a bus probably had a regular sort of medical because he's a bus driver and all that. You can't, allow for the unexpected. But it's not unexpected if somebody's aged 100 driving a car suddenly has a heart attack and dies.
I agree.
Either key style, you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, you're not going to be a 100-year-old bus driver, are you? But
no.
So it can happen to anybody. But I think for the sake of other people's safety, over the age of 80, don't drive anymore.
I totally agree. Now, tell me, what do you make of the latest load of drivel from old Harry over in America telling us that 69 million raindrops drop every day on, you know, wherever he lives now, not California, certainly. And every one of us is a raindrop, apparently.
Oh, well, she's got to him, hasn't she?
Well, she must have done, because I looked at it and this is utter drivel. Imagine yourself as one of the 69 million raindrops that drop on, you know, he mentioned some town every day and all that. And imagine you're one of them and what good you'll be. This is coming from his £11 million mansion with 16 bathrooms. This guy's gone off his rocker, in my view.
He's so out of touch now, and I think it's such a shame. There was a moment there, especially around Remembrance Sunday, when I thought he's really feeling the detachment now, and there will come a time when he reestablishes his relationship with the royal family.
Yes.
But he seems to have gone a little bit over the edge now, and I'd be very interested to see how this pans out with Harry and Meghan.
Yeah, so would I, because I can't see it. You know, I cannot see it ending up in his favour at all. The odds are stacked against him. She's in her town. She's with her friends. She's got her values. She's set up the business plan with Netflix. I think he's a captive. And I think the problem is he's such a captive now, he doesn't know where he's going or how to get out of it. In this day and age, Leslie Ann, and we've mentioned already once or twice, you know, the vaccine might even be getting rolled out towards the end of this week, believe it or not, certainly next week. If they said to you, right, you can have complete freedom of movement now, but you've got to carry a vaccine passport, so i.e. you want to go into a bar, you produce your passport. You want to go to a theatre, you produce your passport. You want to, you know, go to a restricted area, you produce your passport, which proves you've had your jab. Would you object to that?
Absolutely not. Yes, of course I'll carry a vaccine passport. Civil rights campaigners are saying that this is abuse. It's not abuse. Neither, by the way, is the opt-out organ donating scheme.
No, I totally agree.
You know, I think this is perfectly normal. Yeah. We've all got to do this for the sake of everybody else.
No, I totally agree as well. It's like in our thing in our last podcast, we talked about the number of cameras in this country, you know, and well, if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to fear. And you're absolutely right. Well, what about the idea that a lot of people might reject taking the vaccine? Would you say that they should, by law, have to take the vaccine for the benefit of the majority?
The trouble is you can't enforce
that.
No,
you can't.
Because we live in a democratic country, so people do have a choice. The trouble is, if not enough people take up the vaccine, the efficacy for everybody else is less.
Yes, that's right.
So it's in all our best interests to take it, not just for our own sake, but for the sake of our fellow countrymen.
Yeah, no.
And indeed for the rest of the world.
No, I so totally agree with you. It's what I don't understand is somebody who stands on principle and says, well, no, I'm not going to. Even like a Jehovah's Witness who says, no, my child can't have a blood transplant, a blood transfusion. I mean, that is such a horribly individual and selfish attitude to take to life, isn't it?
I personally would say that was abuse, preventing your child from having a life-saving procedure.
So would I. But unfortunately, it happens. Leslie Ann, as always, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I just want to tell our millions of listeners a little story here which warms my heart. As you know, I'm quite fond of relaying stories about war heroes because my father was a war hero. He joined the Royal Navy at 17 in 1914. He came out in 1946 at 23 years of age, and he'd participated in the Royal Navy in the D-Day landings, you know, so I know all about all that. So what about this? In early October 1943, Ken Cook was flying as a radar navigator and bomb aimer in an Avro Lancaster aircraft of No. 9 Squadron on a nighttime raid over the German city of Kassel. Ken Cook, the man concerned, was 20 years of age, okay, lying in the belly of a Lancaster as the navigator and bomb aimer. The RAF force had been detected while approaching its target by Luftwaffe Messerschmitt night fighters and Cook's plane, skippered by an Australian named Jim Comans, soon came under attack. The German aircraft was extremely close, and its pilot was firing from below to try to ignite the bomb load on the Lancaster, which, if successful, would have blown the plane to smithereens. This boy, right, that was one of his first missions. He did 45 missions flying at nighttime in Lancasters over German cities, bombing them while being attacked by the Luftwaffe and what they call the ACK-ACK fire from the Germans below. Can you imagine such bravery?
Unbelievably courageous. For many years, I went to the blue plaque lunches. You know, the organization that puts the blue plaques on the fronts of buildings because some celebrated person lived there. And the wing commanders of Bomber Command were the guests of honor at those lunches. And of course, each year when we rocked along for these events, fewer and fewer of them turned up each time because they were dying off. And I often thought, sitting there, that they were lovely old men, sort of, you know, gentlemanly, dignified. And I used to think to myself, how did they feel knowing that they killed all those innocent people, especially all those children? I know they were doing their duty, but what a terrible burden to carry, to have effectively been responsible for the slaughter of so many.
Yeah, but hang on, we didn't start it, if you see what I mean. We have to go and try and stop it.
No, I'm not saying we did.
No, we have to go.
Yes, of course. But those who lose their lives are always the innocent.
Yeah, well, only two people start wars, and that's the leader of the two countries involved, usually. And they're usually, dictators, as certainly Hitler was. But no, my heart goes out to people like that. I mean, I would never say of our current batch of 20-year-olds, and you've had a son who's been 20, that they'll, you couldn't get them to do it today, because we don't know. We don't know. When put in that situation, maybe people who are 20 years of age today would rally to the call, and they would just sign up and go and put themselves in incredible danger for the sake of their country. We just don't know, do we?
No, and they wouldn't have a choice, of course. They would be called up, and that'd be that. But, you know, World War III, we heard about it so many times, haven't we, that what with nuclear weapons these days, they wouldn't last 3 minutes.
Well, nobody would. I don't think there'll be any soldiers fighting in future wars. You've got robots on the battlefield. You've got missiles that can circumnavigate the world. Why would you need to send anybody into combat anymore, you know? But anyway, look.
Yeah, it's cyber and viral war now, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. But anyway, look. That's not a warmongering report from ours. I just told you about that because Wing Commander Ken Cook, DFC, bomb aimer with Bomber Command, was born on April the 9th, 1923, and died yesterday of complications from COVID-19 on November the... Sorry, died recently from COVID-19 on November the 24th, 2020, aged 97. And I just thought it was nice.
Wow, may he rest in peace.
Exactly, just nice to pay a bit of a tribute to a guy like that who did so much for his country. Right, okay, Miss Jones. Well, there we are, another podcast completed. Really great to have a chat with you again. And would you please pass on my very best wishes to our mutual friend, Mr. Piers Morgan, when you see him on the set next week.
It'll be my great pleasure to do that, Michael.
Thank you very much indeed. And for everybody else, thank you for listening. I thought, this is very funny. Went back into the lounge, but walked further into the lounge than he had at first to find Ivor dead, lying sort of prostrate on his couch. So he was hidden to George the first time by the back of the couch. You see what I mean?
Do you think you might mean prostrate?
Prostrate, that's right. What did I say?
Prostate.
Oh, prostate. No, that's the...
That's a whole different ballgame.
A whole different ballgame.
Ballgame, get it?
The sort of thing that starts to worry men of my, you know, age. But anyway, not yet, thank God. I just thought I'd let you know that, you know? So after about 5 minutes, we said, where's old Ray gone, or whatever his name was, you know?
What, he fell asleep in the snow?
He fell asleep face down on this car. He was so drunk.
So what, did he asphyxiate? Did he freeze to death?
Well, this is the point of the story. So somebody said, where's Ray? So somebody went outside, said, he's outside, but he seems to have fainted and he's fallen forward on the bonnet of the car. I said, oh, well, you better get him off. He said, no, you can't. Why? He said, the temperature's going down and the wool in the lapels on his sheepskin coat are firmly attached to the ice on the front of the car. It's impossible to get him off. So we all went out, and it's true, he was welded to the car by ice. We have to be extremely certain about these things, sir. I would like you to give the man who you believe to be deceased the kiss of life.